16th, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont-Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Alberelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Alberelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps, notably horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved, and afterwards the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? You think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus long held responsible for the incident at Pont-Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made. And if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't. And so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out. Therefore, we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont-Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain. or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have been done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well-balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety-producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. an introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the position of our family when it comes to charity and generosity when living an Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor, dear friends, to be at your service. So we're talking about the position and the status of our family members when it comes to charity and generosity. Now, sometimes people have a tendency to not really know who to be generous with or who to give charity to. Now, unfortunately, we have this conception and this idea in our minds that the people who deserve our generosity and our charity the most are individuals who are far removed from us, meaning there are individuals who we don't know. They are individuals who you have to kind of find because they're hiding, you know, or there are individuals who we have no relation with. Now, this tends to cause certain problems because in a very beautiful Islamic economic and financial system and in an Islamic lifestyle, we find that every individual is responsible financially, spiritually, morally, ethically, and in our discussion, charitably with those people that are in their immediate circle. And if everybody were to take care of the people in these different aspects in their immediate circle, then all of these circles together create a society. And matter of fact, in this manner, you probably wouldn't have individuals who are poor or are needy, because everybody is taking care of their own. It is when we forget to take care of our own on a, you know, familial and family level that on a societal level we end up turning into problems. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about charity and generosity and how we need to primarily focus on our family members. Now, we kind of started to talk a little bit about it in the previous segment, but we're going to try to close it off in this segment of Islamic lifestyle. Now, what we are talking about, of course, is that if every individual were to take care of their immediate family members, so, you know, we're talking about like your spouse, your children, your parents, your siblings, right? These individuals that are your close-knit family members, they are your nuclear family members, if you will. We're not talking about relatives or cousins or friends or these kind of individuals. Those family members that are very close to us. Many a time, it is these individuals who are in need. They need your charity, they need your generosity, and they need your help. But for some reason, we end up overlooking these very individuals. Now, we're not saying that, you know, your spouse or your children or your parents, they are financially well off and you should still give them charity and you should still be generous. That doesn't make any sense. That does not go along with the definition of charity or generosity. But what is an unfortunate condition and situation is that there are times when these same individuals, our spouses or our children or our parents or our siblings, are in need, yet we don't help them. Now, when we don't help those people in our immediate circle, we really can't help and expect other people in their other circles to come out of their circle and help ours. And so if everybody helps their own circle, these circles will create a society which is strong and independent and definitely will be able to better live an Islamic lifestyle. ¶¶
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
History of Iranian carpets.
Part 1.
In the Safavid era, carpets gained a distinguished status and valuable carpets were woven. After the Safavid era, the quality of Iranian carpets gradually decreased. Sometimes it flourished and sometimes declined. In this episode, we'll review the history of Iranian carpets after the end of the Safavid era until the present day. This is Khorshid Palace in Kalat city of Khorasan, Razavi province, a monument that remains from Nader Shah Afshar's era. After the fall of Isfahan by the Afghans and the murder of Shah Sultan Hussein Safavi, the situation in Iran was chaotic for a long time, until a general from the Afshar tribe named Nader defeated the Afghans in several battles and started a war against the Europeans and the Ottoman Empire. Although Nader managed to return Bahrain, Kandahar, and Khwarazm and Bukhara to the territory of Iran, he did not pay any attention to the evolution of art, particularly carpet weaving. During this era and the chaos after his death, no valuable carpet were woven. However, the tradition was followed by nomads and the artists of this industry in small towns. It is difficult to recognize the carpets left from the Afsharid era, because this era was not so long. So the design and pattern of carpets didn't undergo fundamental changes, so the carpets of this era can't be recognized through that. However, written documents show that carpet weaving flourished in some regions of Iran. According to a report by the East India Company, the EIC, beautiful silk and woolen carpets were abundant in the Bandar Abbas market in 1738. In the middle of the 17th century CE, Portuguese explorer Pedro Teixeira has also spoken about carpet weaving in Yazd and has singled out carpets among the most distinguished carpets in Iran. Mohammad Kazim Marvi, the minister of Marv and the author of the historiography of Alam Are Nadari, has also talked about Nader Shah's order to the province of Kerman to send rugs, felt carpets, and other high-quality goods to Yerevan's church. All these written documents indicate that carpet weaving was not abandoned in the Afsharid era, but it did not have a chance to progress amid the chaos of those days. This is Karim Khan's citadel in the center of Shiraz, which was built during the reign of Karim Khan Zand. After Karim Khan chose Shiraz as the capital and this place as his residence, it became known as Karim Khan Citadel. After Karim Khan Zand ascended the throne, the country experienced a relative calm. The calm that prepared the ground for the progress of the carpet industry. The globetrotters who were in Iran during the era of Karim Khan and his successors have mentioned the carpets of our country in their writings. Karsten Niebuhr, a Dutch explorer who was in Shiraz in 1765, wrote that Turkmen, women, and Turkish-speaking Fars nomad weave carpets that are exported in large quantities. It's a wonder that in spite of lack of facilities and equipment, they dye wool very well and weave good carpets. This palace, known as Aga Mohammed Khan Qajar Palace, dates back to the early Qajar era and is actually considered the first palace of this era. At the end of the Zand era, Aga Mohammed Khan Qajar took advantage of the internal crisis after the death of Karim Khan Zand, and after disposing Loft Ali Khan Zand, he was crowned as the King of Iran. This is how the Qajar era began. Like the Afsharids and the Zands, the Qajars were not able to set up large royal workshops and boost the art of Iranian carpet weaving to reach the fame of the Safavid era through supporting well-known carpet weavers and designers. However, the Qajar kings used to order magnificent carpets for their palaces or holy sites. That's why exquisite carpets remained from that era. In this relatively long period, artists created new works based on the precious heritage left from the history of Iranian art, particularly the Safavid era. This carpet with an inscription belonged to the era of Fath Ali Shah. It is kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. The weaving of this carpet with inscriptions took 4 years in Kanamoy workshop of Tabriz and was completed in 1808. The pattern and the design of the carpet is completely creative. In the carpet design, the Shahnameh scenes are pictured in 25 frames, in the style of miniature paintings, and in the spaces between the frames, poems describing each scene are written. Another antique carpet of the Qajar era dates back to the reign of Mohammed Khan Qajar as the Crown Prince. This carpet was woven in the year 1832 by the order of Crown Prince Mohammed Mirza. The pile and warp of this carpet is made of silk, and its creative design and color have made it special. This carpet was woven in Heris, one of the cities of East Azerbaijan province, and it's kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. To mention one of the beautiful carpets of the Qajar era, we need to refer to the large carpet in the mirror hall of the Golestan Palace. This carpet was woven in Moshkabad, Herat city, and is kept in the treasury of Golestan National Palace. It is interesting that in the painting of the mirror hall of Kamal ul-Mulk, the famous painter of the Qajar era, the carpet is carefully depicted. We go to Kerman from the Golestan Palace's mirror hall. One of the active cities in carpet weaving in the Qajar era. This carpet, with a design known as Meliat, nationalities, is an exquisite carpet woven in Kerman. In the main field of the rug, there's a tree with three main branches, and on its branches are fruits such as apples, pears, pomegranates, and grapes, and different kinds of birds, including parrots, swallows, sparrows, crows, owls, peacocks, and different kinds of animals, including ostriches, turkeys, ducks, drakes, and even water animals can be seen in a lake in the background at the bottom edge of the carpet. On the main border of the carpet, there are 10 circular frames with images of 10 different nationalities wearing traditional clothes. This carpet has an inscription at the bottom edge of the main field, which shows that it was woven in 1898 by Master Abulghasim Kermani, and the designer was Forsad ad-Dawleh Shirazi, the famous designer in Kerman. In the margin of this carpet, there are images of people from different nationalities with animal species of the same regions. This carpet is made of wool and yarn and is known by the names of Forsat Shirazi and Meliat. It is kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. The Cyprus peacock carpet is another carpet from the Qajar era, and this one is also woven in the city of Kerman. If we pay attention to the design of this carpet, we can see the cypress and the vase in the center of the carpet, which is surrounded by a frame with a prayer niche design. There are two peacocks next to the cypress vase as guardian and sacred birds. Many flowers can be seen on the border and in the inner field of the carpet, which are a symbol of the Garden of Paradise. There are paisley patterns in the border and the cypress's inner design. Paisley is the shape of a bent cypress tree and is itself a symbol of the cypress tree. The two other peacocks can be seen on top of the cypress tree. The warp and weft of this carpet is made of cotton and the pile is made of wool. In the upper part of the carpet, the names of the carpet weavers can be seen. This carpet is also kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. The mentioned carpets were some of the famous carpets of the Qajar era, but a relatively large group of carpets from the Qajar era are pictorial carpets, a significant number of which are kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. Pictorial carpets in the Qajar era included images of kings and notables, ancient motifs, and special design. One of the carpets in the Carpet Museum of Iran shows the image of Hushang Shah in his old age, and with a white bear sitting on a throne, like a royal throne. This is while two devils are carrying the throne. This design is inspired by the story of Hu Shangsha's battle with the demons and their subjugation by Hu Shang in Shaname. In the margin of the carpet, there are animal motifs such as camels and cows, which are noticeable due to the balanced coloring. The pictorial carpet of Hu Shangsha was woven in Kerman and is kept in the Carpet Museum of Iran. Mashaher, Luminary's Carpet, is another beautiful pictorial carpet in the Qajar era, which has been designed with 109 Iranian kings, 54 world's famous people, and 16 images of Sassanid and Achaemenid era rock reliefs. This carpet was designed in 1920 by Hassan Khan Shakuri and woven by Master Ali Kermani. The border of this carpet is adapted from the book Ajam, authored by Forsad Od-Dole Shirazi. In the lower part of the inner field of the carpet, there's a picture of Ahmad Shah Qajar, and in the middle field, which is oval, some notables are designed. In the middle of the carpet, the royal throne is less visible and is mostly designed and covered with plant motifs. This carpet is kept in the Niavaran Palace Complex. Among other exquisite pictorial carpets of the Qajar era is this carpet, which is called the Astrolabe or Mintaka al-Buruj carpet. Astrolabe carpet is one of the most beautiful carpets of Isfahan, which has a very rare design. The design of the carpet is medallion corner, and the central medallion is circular. Symbols and names of different months and years are woven on the circle in Persian, Turkish, and Arabic. The symbols are taken from the old Christian calendar. And the lower head medallion represents the moon, and in the four edges of the rug, there are four symbols of the four planets of the solar system, Jupiter, Mercury, Venus, and Mars.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
ودعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان. ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
السلام عليكم. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRB English Radio, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions held by IRIB English Radio in cooperation with Sevier International Schools Network. So here we are with Brother Ali Nasir, Hassan Nasrullah, and Hussein Rohullah. Assalamu alaikum, brothers, and welcome. And how are you, Hassan?
Fine, sir. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much, Ali Nasir.
Alhamdulillah, sir.
That's good. Hussein?
Alhamdulillah, sir.
Thank you so much. Welcome. I really welcome you all. So in this session, inshallah, we'll talk about Ayah 87 and 88, the two verses in Surah Ali Imran on page 61, right? So, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين and خالدين فيها لا يخفف عنهم العذاب ولا هم ينظرون. So let's listen once, everyone.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين خالدين فيها لا يخفف عنهم العذاب ولا هم ينظرون.
Great recitation, alhamdulillah. I really loved it. So Hassan, can you read it once? Ayah 87.
Yes, sir.
أعوذ بالله.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين.
أحسنتم. Thank you. Hussein, can you read the next ayah?
Yes, sir. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم خالدين فيها لا يخفف عنهم العذاب ولا هم ينظرون.
أحسنتم. Mashallah. Now we will explain these two verses, then inshallah we'll move on to the tajweed rules. أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين. Their requital, okay, is their punishment. The punishment of those who what? Those who wrong themselves, okay? كيف يهدي الله قوما كفروا بعد إيمانهم مرتدين, okay? Those who commit irtidad. Okay, apostasy, like they believe once and then they again turn away and then they disbelieve to their faith. So, what is their punishment? Their punishment is that there shall be upon them the curse of Allah, the angels, and all mankind. لعنت الله ولعنت الملائكة ولعنت الناس أجمعين. They will remain خالدين فيها. They will remain in it, in that curse, in that عذاب, forever. لا يخفف عنهم العذاب. And their punishment shall not be lightened. Shall not be decreased. ولا هم ينظرون. Nor will they be granted any respite. Okay? They will not be, like, paid attention to them. Nobody will pay attention to them. Okay? ولا هم ينظرون. Guys, these two verses talk about the punishment of those who commit irtidad, okay? They believe once and then they turn away and they disbelieve. They committing irtidad, all right? So about the rules and the ahkam of irtidad, I told you in the previous verses that inshallah you can refer to the Islamic rulings, okay? That so someone who commits irtidad, okay? We have two types of irtidad, irtidad fitri and milli in ahkamic rulings, okay? And then inshallah, you refer to the tafasir books as well as the ahkamic rulings, inshallah, okay? In the discussion about irtidad, okay? So, Ali Nasir, Hassan and Hussein, let's move on to the important tajweed rules that we'll mention, inshallah, and our brothers and sisters will for sure listen, inshallah, and take notes.
IRIB English Radio, in cooperation with Xavier International Schools, presents Let's Recite the Quran.
وبختم كتابك أرقى
وبختم كتابك أرقى.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين. Our brother Hassan recited this ayah. Now let's mention the important tajweed rules. Then Hassan will recite them with tajweed rules. Okay?
Yes.
أولئك. The mad is wajib, right?
Yes.
Since the alif, ula, a, and the hamza, ika, are in the same word, in the word ula'ika, ula'i, ula'i. Ka is like the letter for takhatub, for khitab, for talking. Ula'ika, O Prophet, they are. Look, ka means O Prophet, you. Ula'i means those. O Prophet, those are. Okay, talking to the Prophet, pointing to them. Ula'ika, O Prophet, I'm talking to you. They are about they. Okay, about them, okay? They are, أولئك جزاؤهم, they are those who their punishment is, okay, like this. أولئك, so, mad is wajib for how many counts?
Six counts,
okay. أولئك, right, six counts. جزاؤهم, so, Hussein, is the mad in the word جزاؤهم, is it wajib as well, mandatory?
I think it's not wajib.
It's not. Jaza'u. Jaza'u.
Yes, jaza is another word.
Jaza'u. Ends with hamza.
Yes, but yeah.
It's mandatory. It's wajib, right? Yeah. Wajib muttasil. So it says, well, wajib muttasil. Jaza'u. Hamza is in the word jaza'u, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Ula'ika jaza'uhum. So we should stretch the sounds, okay, both are wajib. Anna, nun mushaddad, Hassan, you should produce a nasal?
Nasal sound.
Nasal sound. Anna, ghunna sound. Alayhim, la'natallahi. Do not read it, la'natullah, okay? Anna, when the word, when the noun comes after anna, okay? We have an ismu anna, okay? Is mansub, it's called. You should read it with fatha la'nata. Not na'natu, la'natallahi. And also the word Allah, the letter in the word Allah, the letter lam, is pronounced with a light sound or heavy sound?
Heavy.
Heavy, because
there fatha.
Is a fatha before, la'nata. Okay, if you join it to the word Allah, Allah is pronounced with an a sound. Allah, la'natallahi wal malaikati wan nasi ajma'in. Malaika, we've mentioned a lot. It's wajib, the mad, yes. Stretch it. Wannasi, hamzatul wasl is escaped. Noon mushaddad, nasal sound as Hussein, as Hassan said. Ajma'in, jim, sakin. Hussein, what is the rule for jim, sakin?
Qalqala.
Qalqala. You should produce an echoing sound, a bouncing sound. Let it jump.
Yes.
Ajma'in. And stretch the sound at the end. Okay? Let me read it once and repeat after me.
أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين. أولئك جزاؤهم أن عليهم لعنة الله والملائكة والناس أجمعين.
أحسن. لعنة الله. أوكي. تا. طانو. لعنة الله. So تا is not a heavy word. Yes. Heavy letter.
Yeah.
So next ayah. خالدين فيها. خا. An A sound. Make sure it is a heavy letter. خالدين فيها. Ha is a light word, a light letter. خالدين فيها لا يخفف. Make sure the تشديد on فا. لا يخفف. And خا is a heavy letter as well. عنهم العذاب. عنهم. Nun ساكن plus ha. The rule says it is. عنهم. Noon says
plus ha.
Plus ha. It says what?
Izhar,
nothing. Don't do anything with the noon, okay? Just read it. Anhum, pronounce the noon. Anhumul adhab. Pay attention to the pronunciations of the letters. Ayn and ha. Ha. Wala hum yunzarun. Yunzarun. Hassan, tell us, what comes after noon sakin? Yunzarun.
What comes after noon sakin?
Yeah. Yunzarun. Dha. Yes?
Yes.
So, dha is from the rest of the letters. You should pronounce it with hiding sound. The noon. Yes? The sound of noon will be hidden. Wala hum yunzarun. Right? Yes. Let me read it. Repeat after me. خالدين فيها لا يخفف عنهم العذاب ولا هم ينظرون
خالدين فيها لا يخفف عنهم العذاب ولا هم ينظرون
أحسنتم. This is the way we recited with Tajweed rules. صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
Thank you so much. Allah bless you, inshallah. Okay, that's from us for today, brothers and sisters. Thank you so much for being with IRB English Radio up to this point. Allah bless you, inshallah wa ta'ala. So we'll be here again with you in the coming sessions. Tomorrow the same day, stay with IRB English Radio with next coming Quranic sessions. So, Hassan Hussein Ali Nasir, a bunch of thanks to you for being with us today. Any questions, anything to say?
Note.
Allah bless you, inshallah. Include us in your du'as, and may Allah hasten the reappearance of Imam Al-Mahdi, inshallah. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.